Welcome to the podcast. Today, Rob Hamilton, CEO of AnchorWatch, breaks down Bitcoin insurance, Miniscript-powered custody, and what real innovation looks like in Bitcoin finance. Let's dive in. As a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. We encourage you to do your own research. If you enjoy the content we're producing, please remember to like, share, subscribe, drop us a comment, as this all helps our show grow organically. Thank you.
This isn't for everyone. It's for the ones who know the old system is broken and are ready to build something that lasts. Welcome to the Build with Bitcoin podcast.
Co-host Israel Munoz, joined with co-host Len Bairstow. Today we have the great pleasure of welcoming onto the podcast Rob Hamilton, CEO and co-founder at AnchorWatch. We've had AnchorWatch on before, but first time having a conversation with you, Rob. So looking forward to it and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We'll try to make the most out of this hour that we have with you, Rob. Plenty to get into. AnchorWatch is working on custody and insurance solutions for Bitcoin. So lots to unpack here. We'll get into a little bit of the product offerings, roadmap, and a lot more interesting conversation regarding what you guys do at AnchorWatch. But we can maybe start with you as CEO and co-founder, Rob. Can you share with the audience a little bit about what got you to both Bitcoin and AnchorWatch, as much as you want to share about your background?
Yeah, happy to. So I had just graduated college. It's like 2013-ish. And I had a bunch of buddies. Well, I had like two buddies that were telling me like, hey, check out this Bitcoin thing. Check it out. You're a big end the Fed guy. Like, this is up your alley. And I was like, like too complicated. Like, I just kind of passed it by. And then what happened in the fall of 2013 was Dogecoin came out. And I and a bunch of my buddies had our gaming PCs. And they all started mining Dogecoin. It became this whole joke. So then I went and downloaded a Dogecoin miner and I started playing around with the wallet and I could see it all. I was like, okay, I've been around internet culture long enough. I get this is satire. Like they're making fun of something, but let me check out what the actual tech was about. And I was living in the New York City area at the time. And I started going to the New York City Bitcoin developer BitDevs meetup. And I was technical, you could say, like good with computers, but I was not a programmer myself at that point. And I went to these BitDevs meetings and there would be like 12 to 20 people in a room. And I was the dumbest person there by far. And I was just very blown away at the rigor and the thought that was put into building this software project of Bitcoin. And that's where I got really deep into Bitcoin. I started following it along, paying attention to it. I would go to the BitDevs meetups once a month. In between that, every 2 weeks, they would have a builder meetup where everyone would just kind of come hang out, work on whatever projects they're working on. And that's when I started getting like really interested in Bitcoin. I was very passive in the sense as I wasn't really like a Twitter personality. I wasn't doing content or anything. I was just following it along. And over the years was kind of always keeping a beat on it, having some Bitcoin. I was like the token Bitcoin guy at an office telling everyone they should go check out Bitcoin when it was at like $250. Like you should just buy a couple just in case it catches on. And I was that guy all throughout my career until just to very quickly fast forward over that in like 8 years is I started learning how to program, started automating my work, my desk job, ended up taking time off to just do full like coding bootcamp. Like really, really just dig into the details and mechanics of writing software. I got hired. I was at IBM. I left IBM, came back to IBM. I got hired as a data scientist working specifically on large, big data scale models, petabytes of data and doing information analysis. The very, I know this isn't directly Bitcoin, but I used to work the consulting arm at IBM that, was working with the acquisition of the weather company at the time. So all of the weather meteorological data and doing points of interest and showing, hey, there's going to be a pollen spike in tomorrow. So you should start advertising Flonase today kind of stuff. Right. And doing that to like inform media ad buying. I left my job in 2021 and I was thinking about what I wanted to do next. And I took a couple months off just to spend time with family and just kind of like give myself some space to think about what I really wanted to work on next. And that's when the story of AnchorWatch started becoming a conversation. I was spending a lot of time on this app called Clubhouse. I got on it in 2020, like right as like the whole COVID lockdown, everything was taking up, and I would have it online all the time in the background. Instead of listening to podcasts or watching movies, I just have it on the background and like building a good group and network of friends. And that's where I met the initial investors for AnchorWatch, and then also ended up meeting my co-founder, Becca. And so the kickoff story for that was I was juggling a couple job offers within the Bitcoin industry. American HODL, for those that know him, basically said, Rob, you're a smart guy. You should start a company instead of working for someone else. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do that, I want it to be like a really big, ambitious project, something that's like significantly has a chance of changing the infrastructure of the industry. And the idea for insurance came up and started mulling over how I would possibly execute that. And Becca started off as an angel investor. And then I was like day five of sitting in an Airbnb coding out the initial prototype of what became AnchorWatch. And Becca was pulling all-nighters with me just as an investor, an angel investor. And then quickly she asked if she could move over and become co-founder with me. And that was kind of like, you could tie in probably when you guys had Becca on talking about all that part, her side of the story too. But that's been my journey in Bitcoin. AnchorWatch was founded just coming up on 4 years ago. And a lot of that time at the start was focused on figuring out how to properly design a product, actually getting insurance in a way that gave institutional credibility, which is where the Lloyd's of London cover holder status comes in. Insurance is a business that you really can't start in your basement and just turn it on, because you need to have reputable counterparties for capital, where in the event if something goes wrong, who's going to be paying for it? And those are relationships that take time, right? And so I'll put a stop there, but that's a good just condensed who I am, where I came from, and how I got into Bitcoin and started AnchorWatch.
Well, I have some questions.
Please do.
First of all, I was in many of those Clubhouse conversations with you and Becca in the early days. I had just moved to Mexico City, knew nobody, and Clubhouse, Bitcoin Clubhouse was my lifeline. And I also really didn't have a Bitcoin community to connect with until I discovered Clubhouse and I realized there were other people like me. But I also want to touch on the New York BitDevs, because it seems like during those years, I mean, it feels to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you actually kind of shifted your whole professional trajectory based on going to BitDevs and getting interested in programming and interested in Bitcoin. And we've had Marty Bent talk about those early BitDevs in New York. We had Andre Nevis talk about them. Can you just describe what the energy was and how that got you to kind of shift your mindset from big data and data science to Bitcoin?
Well, I loved it. It was a bunch of renegades, really. This is 2013, 2014 Bitcoin. Like, I was at the BitDevs like when the Mt. Gox exchange collapsed. This was before this idea of Bitcoin as an institutional asset. There were a lot more hoodies, a lot less suits. And it was people that were just really passionate about like the mission of Bitcoin and decentralizing money and having a global distributed secure ledger of transactions, right? It was a very interesting time to be there, because you would get to see plenty of actors that would come and go, like would go do presentations and stuff, and people that are like longtime big devs today, but they're just people that are working on a software project. I think the type of person who would get into Bitcoin in 2013 that was very industrious and wanting to lean into the technicals really just picked for like a great type of person you'd want to build a network and get to know better, right? I really, it's one of like my favorite like times of life, like, because I would have to like take the train into the city and I was like going far out of my way to go do this. It was a very, it was like one of the most exciting times of my life for sure. And you don't realize it in that moment. You have to look back on it. But it's one of those things I think about now in working in what I do, keeping that energy going, right? And keeping that excitement and passion. And we would talk about one day Bitcoin would be $10,000. Like, that was like the moon price back then, right? So as that, just the mission and the story just keeps on building. For me, it was also just really powerful to see a bunch of people really hyper-motivated writing software, all sitting in a room writing software together. And that's kind of where the inspiration, where I realized like, hey, if they can do this globally distributed secure ledger, I can start automating my Excel spreadsheets. That's probably pretty reachable, right? And so that was like the really big like aha unlock moment, being surrounded by a bunch of highly motivated, competent engineers as a way to understand the opportunity though it sits in front of me today. And I feel like a bit of what's happening right now in like the AI like craze and everyone starting to mess around with AI tools is that you no longer have to be a hyper motivated person who has to go out of their way to the Bitcoin developer meetup. You can just sit in your house and get a level of resource and access that is orders of magnitude more than what I had back then. I still had to read books, right? There was like 2 Bitcoin podcasts at that time. Like there wasn't a bunch of wealth of information. You had to go dig around and find it. And then you had to go write the code by hand. I remember picking up C++ for Dummies. I never learned how to code in C++. Right. But I look back on if I had those kind of tools today, how much further I'd be able to kind of push myself.
Well, it's certainly an inspiring journey, Rob. And, you know, maybe let's double click on you. You mentioned something that when you were in Clubhouse, you started ideating, you know, if you were to attack, or no, maybe attack is the wrong word, if you were to try to build an insurance solution for the Bitcoin industry, what that would look like. And that's how, of course, you know, we arrive at AnchorWatch today. But can you take us through your thought process of those initial building blocks and what you saw missing or needed?
Yeah. So I think foundationally, insurance as a market is one of the oldest financial markets that existed. Like insurance and lending are like some of the earliest financial kind of contracts we had that you could find back on like stone tablets, right? Just the concept of sharing risk. And it's one of those things that it's not glamorous and sexy. So it's something that often gets overlooked, and it's a heavily regulated industry. But that's where I saw the opportunity and the conviction in knowing that as Bitcoin continues to mature as a financial asset, a risk market, insurance, is going to exist. There's no way Bitcoin is a multi-trillion dollar asset and there's been no evolution in what it takes to do risk management through transferring risk, which is the insurance contract itself. And Bitcoin, I think, was just really well staged thinking about how to design a system around this, because when you self-custody in insurance, you're doing what's called self-insuring. You're holding your own risk. If something goes wrong, you're the one who bears the risk, right? Most people don't think of it in the terms of self-insuring, but that is like the mechanical term of what you're doing. And that's where a lot of emphasis over the evolution of Bitcoin as a protocol came in, with figuring out, okay, we can do seed phrases. We can do multi-sig, right? You start figuring out these ways, because the best way you could do risk management back then was probably risk mitigation and risk distribution. So if I have a 2 of 3 multi-sig, all my eggs are not in one basket, right? And especially when you think about institutional adoption of Bitcoin, insurance is often just table stakes for how financial institutions run their books and do business. They want to understand, if I'm executing a trade or I'm doing something, I want to specifically know what risk am I bearing and what risk can I give to someone else in an insurance contract so they don't have to worry about it, right? And so that was just like the big vision. And the one example I often go to is, if you have a Bitcoin-backed loan, I flip it on for a second and say, let's say you're getting a mortgage for a house. The bank will not close the mortgage and give you the money for the house until it's insured. And why is that? It's because the bank is willing to take a risk and say, if you don't pay your mortgage, we can seize the house and sell the house to someone else. What they are not holding the risk of is, what happens if you burn the house down and I now have an empty lot? Right? The value in which the mortgage is being predicated on is that you have a fully built home there. And that's why you need homeowners insurance, because they don't want to be stuck holding the risk of, what if you're negligent and you burn your house down and you walk away from the mortgage? Now you have a lot that's worth 10 cents on the dollar or whatever it is, right? Then the bank would be underwater. So that this is, I view in the same extension of a Bitcoin-backed loan, that is the natural trajectory of where things will go. And you can roll that into the interest rate for the loan itself. You can just have that be part of the the interest rate that you pay for the loan. It's just that base premise is that this also goes into kind of building out our own custody solution, was that the foundation of being able to offer an insurance product for Bitcoin and cold storage was, we would have to build our own custody product, because otherwise we're just renting someone else's API. We're at the whim of another vendor. We're not able to actually do our own third-party testing, auditing, construction, deeply understanding it. And we're incredibly highly motivated to make sure it all works correctly, because the entire business, compared to, let's say, uninsured custody, is you give me some Bitcoin, I charge you a fee for it, and if something goes wrong, you're an unsecured creditor at the back of the line, right? And so for us, what we do, which is unique compared to most insurance policies that exist today, are what I call like an omnibus policy. So kind of like if you had a custodian with an omnibus, like all the coins sit at this one address, you, if you use a, like the one I always like look to is like Coinbase, right? So Coinbase has an insurance policy. I believe it's around $300 million. That is a fraction of a percent compared to their total assets under custody, right? And to, as a kicker, you, as the customer, are not on the insurance party. You are not party to an insurance contract. The custodian is. And what we do that's, and that what that means mechanically is several things. One, you don't have a direct claim on the insurance policy itself. Only the custodian does. And additionally, there's often ambiguity in understanding where you fall. If the event there is a loss, how much do you get refunded? Or like, you know, the term would be indemnified, to make yourself whole because a loss happened. And we're very unique in that it is your Bitcoin, it is your insurance policy, there's a direct link, and we offer that policy through Lloyd's of London as a Lloyd's of London cover holder. So we have the world's like biggest named like large insurance carriers who are backing this risk. It is not a small operation by any means when it comes to that, who's actually underwriting this risk.
No, the way you frame it, I mean, AnchorWatch for now is primarily your clients or individuals who are looking to have insurance. And we want to get into a lot of that, including what I see is like the killer app for AnchorWatch is the inheritance planning part of it. But the way you're framing it, it almost seems like, you know, up until now, institutions that want to be a part, want to hold Bitcoin or want to have a position in Bitcoin, they've really been kind of funneled into, ETFs or treasury companies or more standard institutional products that are recognized by the system in order to have a position in Bitcoin. But part of that may be just that insurance piece of it. So you are, it looks like AnchorWatch is really set up to kind of solve that part where they feel more confident and comfortable with the risk mitigation, especially when you're dealing with individuals who may come and go inside of a corporate structure.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can actually, any S1 for either any Bitcoin treasury company or ETF or financial wrapper, any sort of publicly listed security that's related to Bitcoin, look through their S1s. There's always immediate disclaimer saying a systemic risk to our business is that there is an issue with the custodian and there is not enough insurance to be able to cover us. And this was the other big idea with AnchorWatch is today, notionally, if you added up all of these omnibus policies, there's maybe somewhere between $3 and $5 billion of total outlaid insurance today. And Bitcoin's a multi-trillion-dollar asset, right? So even like, and I'm not assuming Bitcoin stays flat forever, but even if it were to stay flat, we are not even at 1% penetration when it comes to insured capital for Bitcoin. So I think that's like kind of like why it's the big idea. And our ability to layer insurance, whether even we even have the ability at this point, we can underwrite a third party platform. It doesn't have to be our custody platform with our tech. I think we have built an amazing product. We've been in business now for a little bit over a year, never had an issue once. I plan on compounding that statement every year by every year and saying that everything has been good and stable. But it's something that it takes time and diligence to get all of the pieces in the right spot. And what we're finding now is we're able to quickly accelerate and compound on our firm foundation into continually executing and growing into new product variants. You mentioned the inheritance piece. That's a interesting thing that when we were initially designing our vaults, and we can get a little bit into the technicals of how our vaults maybe differ from anywhere else in the market, the ultimate piece was how do we mitigate risk across many scenarios to know that we would be able to make sure the customer is able to either very cleanly recover their Bitcoin, or in the event that there is a covered loss, be able to pay out the insurance, right? And inadvertently, by going through this process of building a very secure and safe vault, we were able to essentially build a recovery system that acts really nicely for inheritance, where in the event, if you don't interact with the vault for a year, you can reach out to us. And if your keys get destroyed, you can lose your keys, but not your Bitcoin, which is just a very different paradigm to what most people are used to. And that's a little bit into how our technology solution works. I'll keep it very brief and say that Bitcoin as programmable money allows you to do things with it that exist, but most people have not been thinking through how to design applications around. And the simplest example I could say would be you can have a 2 of 3 multi-signature, but maybe after a year, it becomes a 1 of 3 or maybe a 2 of 4. You can add a key that can't do anything for the first year, but then later can come in and step in to help recovery. And that's, and the concept of that is what we use in our vault for being able to help and operate for inheritance. And that's something that was very much a happy thing we realized when we got to the end of it. We're like, wait a second, this is actually really good for inheritance, because you can put money in a Bitcoin address and know that even if you lose all of your keys, there's a way for you to get your Bitcoin back.
Yeah. Lynn and I are partners at Baselayer Advisors, where we use our network of venture capital partners and startup founders to connect investors with unique opportunities within the Bitcoin innovation space. Alongside this, we help startup founders with their growth and fundraising. Visit our website's advisory section to learn more.
And I'd love to get into the programmability and the building blocks kind of behind what AnchorWatch is doing, Rob. But before we do that, I mean, one natural question that might come to mind when you speak to how largely uninsured Bitcoin as an industry is, mm-hmm. would be, well, are those conversations... Are you having them with some of these large institutions and custodians? Where is their comfort level? What's missing? Mm-hmm. The train of thought there that you're seeing?
Yes. So it's interesting. You used like the phrase attack earlier with like attacking this problem, but you have to attack narratives too, because many people in larger financial institutions, like insurance is a checkbox they go through the routines of, and they're like, oh yeah, there's an insurance policy. But some of them won't do the deeper rigor and understand, wait a second, yeah, there's an insurance policy, but there's a dozen asterisks that are meaningful for this, right? And so in the conversations we have with larger institutions, it depends on where they are in their journey. Sometimes we have to start with that education and enablement to make sure they understand what they're exactly engaging in when they say that their partner is insured. But beyond that, I think it's quickly becoming something of focus to understand where risk like resides and understanding what you're paying for in a service. And I think an insurance premium is the most natural aligned way to have a custodian relationship. I'm helping you safeguard your Bitcoin. For that, there is a fee. And in the event something goes wrong, you get directly indemnified. And when you explain that to institutional holders, it immediately makes sense. And what we've seen in Bitcoin up to this point is that Bitcoin gets viewed strictly as software. And because it gets viewed strictly as software, people think of it through like a SaaS paradigm, where the cost to build the infrastructure, the costs get driven down. I can charge a variable fee based on the amount you're custodying with me. And then I get really great margins, because the marginal cost for me to secure 1 Bitcoin versus 1,000 Bitcoin, it's a very low marginal cost to secure a little bit. Like, and the way the Bitcoin works is you either have, if you have an address and you need to put something in there, as far as the network's concerned, all of security properties are baked in. It's not like if you have 100 Bitcoin, you get extra properties on the network compared to $1 of Bitcoin. So this is, I think, an early stage of Bitcoin maturing as a capital asset. And I think that's an important distinction here of Bitcoin not just being software, but it is money and it's capital. And because it's that, when you're thinking about differentiating with a business, something I thought of a while back is, while open source software and software can like commoditize it to zero, you can't open source capital. Like the balance and the money itself is not something that can be infinitely copyable in that way. And I think of it this way, because I think that's why insurance ultimately at the end of the day is a capital market. It's almost like investment banking by another name. And with that, you start thinking about it through that lens of treating it as a product and how you build services. I think it's way more compelling, one, as a way to frame the problem to go attack it as a business and an entrepreneur. But also when you start explaining it in these terms to anyone who's holding a large Bitcoin position, they immediately understand, saying, wait, I actually do have a large amount of risk sitting on my balance sheet because I have my coin sitting at this particular custodian that I don't have direct party or ability to procure insurance for.
Rob, as you're talking, you're talking about this, the protocol of Bitcoin. You're talking about some of the I think people think of it as an asset, or they, to your point, they think of it as software, but they don't understand the protocol aspect of it. And there's been an entire I don't know, 20,000 tokens built around the Web3 ecosystem that are, I think at essence, they're claiming to do things that Bitcoin can't do because of how it operates. But you're kind of proving this wrong. And I'd like to talk to you about why you didn't go in a different direction, why you stayed with Bitcoin. Obviously, we're all Bitcoin believers here, but it must be in the back of some people's mind, like, why not go with another protocol that has this, you know, more easily built in? But
yeah, well, I think that's, I guess, like the first thing to discuss is it being easily built in. So when you have, there's several places where I'm going to go with this question. So the first thing is that I'll even start just in insurance. Insurance as a long enduring capital market, you're talking about year long plus insurance policies. Those are not things that you want to have random fly by night tokens as they come up in value and down in value. No one's looking to insure their Shiba Inu for 2 years, right? Like, everyone understands the game that they're playing with, like the high velocity of trading those things around. Additionally, most of the, if you want to call it like the larger crypto ecosystem monetization, has been around the listing of many assets and charging trading fees, where you just keep it on the platform and you swap between different things. And every single time you do a trade, the exchange or the service provider gets to take a little bit of a piece of it, right? Whereas Bitcoin, if you're talking about long-term storage, one, from an engineering standpoint of just building the product, that's tech debt. Every incremental product that you have to adopt, you have to adopt that for year, multi-year horizon. And if you want to deprecate it, you have to give, you know, a very long notice to have safe migrations and pieces. My conviction in Bitcoin is that I'm not going to be pivoting to another asset anytime soon. So investing in Bitcoin specific architecture is not something that I have to worry about incurring tech debt because I chose to work with Bitcoin. The next thing is just on the insurance side and a risk perspective, the nature of Bitcoin and its programmability is way more constrained. And this is something you'll typically hear in the Web3 narratives versus Bitcoin, that Bitcoin has very limited or no contracting ability at all. And all of these other ecosystems have vibrant programmability. That is a massive risk exposure across many domains. Understanding, is the actual foundational language being written correctly? The compiler you're using to write these smart contracts, so the right version that don't have any bugs in them. Making sure that even if all those pieces are correct, like the foundational ecosystem, did you write the contract correctly? Is there a bug in there that can cause someone to nuke their money? There's been plenty of bugs. If you like look at Ethereum and Solana, where either through actors, like honest actors doing something wrong, or a malicious attacker attacking the contract on chain, like a third party, that you can actually destroy money sitting in these more advanced smart contracts. And so the nature of Bitcoin is that because it's much more bounded in what it can do, you can have more definitive certainty and understanding around how the money can be secured on chain at rest that allow you to provide security, understandings, and assurances. A very basic example of how this ultimately boils down to AnchorWatch is, for the length of your insurance policy, AnchorWatch has to co-sign the transaction to move funds. And I can see that very simply, definitively, because the first thing in one of our addresses is a 2 of 3 multisig with AnchorWatch's 3 keys, 2 of the 3 must sign. There is no hacking of the Bitcoin blockchain and protocol that would allow for that rule to get violated, right? And so when it came to like designing and picking up Bitcoin specifically, this was an interesting moment in the evolution of AnchorWatch, because the custody platform we have today with Trident Vault was not something that was part of the initial pitch of the company. The initial premise of the company is we were going to do proof of ownership doing a signed message. So I made a nice little website where you can click a couple buttons. You can prove, hey, I have a 2 of 3 multisig, one of my keys. I have them right here. I'm signing a message proving I own it. And then we would insure third-party people doing like multi-signatures. Now, we realized this was part of the first year of the journey and figuring things out. And I think this is an important lesson too. For that first year, one, it was only 3 people. It was Becca, myself, and we had 1 engineer. And I didn't take a salary for the first year. We kept it very small, very tight, understanding that we needed the space to be able to operate. So we needed to be able to, we wanted to stumble around and learn, one, before the platform was even live. Two, being a first-time founder, Becca also being a first-time founder, making sure that we could fully wrap our head around this and give ourselves the time and ability to be able to actually execute on this vision and opportunity. And it was one of these things that by being slow and diligent, I got to deeper and deeper think about the problem more and more. As someone who'd been in Bitcoin for a while, I put a lot of thought and pieces into these things. But after a year of waking up every single day and thinking about this problem from every angle, realizing this was one of the big aha moments within the company, was that this more robust programmability was sitting right there and no one was really using it. And this is, I think I mentioned briefly earlier, Miniscript, this way that we use these more advanced programmability options in Bitcoin, was actually built by Blockstream back in 2019 and 2020. And then sat on the shelf. And I had a fateful day. I'll have to look at my emails. Either it was like October or November of 2022. And I emailed Andrew Polstra, who is the director of research at Blockstream. He was one of the inventors of Miniscript. And he's also one of the prolific Bitcoin protocol developers when it comes time for coding up Taproot or SegWit, all of these big changes that Bitcoin has. He's one of the people who is usually reviewing it or writing the code itself to actually be able to get it live. And I messaged him and I was like, you know, hey, I met you once at a conference. I just have to ask you a quick question. Why is no one else using this software? Like this Miniscript stuff that you wrote, it's brilliant. No one's touching it. And I want to understand from your perspective before I pivot my company into building on top of this, is there something that I'm missing? And he replied, he said, no, it's all great. No issues or problems at all. The only problem is none of the hardware wallets support it. And I sent him a link from Ledger saying Ledger just added it this week. And he said, oh, no one told me. And it was in that moment I realized, wait a second, I'm so early and on top of this that the man who like spearheaded and helped build all of this wasn't even aware that the hardware wallets were now adopting what he built. And I realized that is important. The hardware wallets are important for a last mile clean user experience for a person to be able to participate in these arrangements, where once you set up your ledger, signing an Anchor, like a Trident Vault transaction, is identical to signing a single signature. You just click, you look at the amount you're sending, you say the fee, you hit okay, good to go. And that was like the really big takeoff point, realizing that with the democratization of this tech being able to get embedded into hardware wallets, that I no longer had to worry about building custom clients or custom software or custom anything. I could plug into the existing ecosystem in a really clean way that would allow everyone to be able to kind of leverage these properties of Bitcoin as programmable money.
Can you go a little deeper into that programmability and what Miniscript is? I mean, we said the word and we talked a little bit around it, but just to give a little bit more context about how it actually functions.
I would say there's probably on my two hands, I could count maybe, you know, 5 to 10 people who may have been more, the three people who invented it. I mentioned Andrew Polstra, Peter Willa, and Sanket Kandelhar, the three guys when they were all at Blockstream, invented it. The way I describe it in a casual conversation is I view Miniscript as bowling with bumpers. You can't throw a gutter ball. If I, and this is actually a really funny story, before I figured out Miniscript, I realized, wait, Bitcoin has this programming language that Satoshi invented. And people, even if you don't know it, you do, because the idea of like a multisig, there is what's called an opcode, which does an operation in the Bitcoin scripting language. Opcheck multisig. What does that do? It checks the multisig. Opcheck sig, it checks, is the signature valid or not, right? And there's a couple of other pieces. And what Miniscript does is it creates basically little Lego bricks you can put together to get a more involved way that you can manage your money. I mentioned an example earlier, a 2 of 3, but if the money has not moved for a year, you can make it a 1 of 3 or a 2 of 4. The one wallet that's out right now that's free and open source, and they were on this a bit before me, are Liana Wallet. Kevin Loeck is the founder, CEO over there. He's a great guy. You should probably have him on to talk about his own stuff too, but he also leverages Miniscript. The interesting tools you get with Miniscript, There's actually three ways Bitcoin can secure money, realistically, in the language. One, signatures. Do you have the private key or not? There's also time locks. So in 2013 and in 2014, Bitcoin added time locks to Bitcoin. This was really important for the Lightning Network. And we don't have to go into a Lightning Network conversation how Lightning is secured, but it relies on time locks to make sure that all actors are honest. And then the final piece is called a hash lock, which most people, it's not something I would directly delve into right now. Basically, if you know a secret, you can reveal the secret, and that's different than a key. I don't want to get too deep in the technical nuances I could have, but it's part of actually how the Lightning Network works too. They use hash time-locked contracts. That's HTLC. That's what Lightning uses. So what Miniscript does is it lets you combine these little pieces, and they also add like logic of and or. So I can say, if AnchorWatch 2 of 3 signed plus the customer key, then the money can move. That would be an example of a way you could use it. And then you could say, or if the money hasn't moved in a year, maybe it's AnchorWatch and a recovery partner, because then we can return the funds to you. Or maybe if in the context of an insurance contract, after the insurance contract expires, you by yourself, you can just move the money. Because if we don't have an insurance contract with you anymore and you don't want to work with us, the typical dynamic, if you want to get off a custodian, is to get on the phone with them or send them an email or request a transaction. But ultimately, once our contractual obligation with the insurance is over, you by yourself can take the money out of your Trident vault without talking to us. And that's kind of like built by design. So at the highest level, if I tried coding these by hand, you could, in theory, code the Bitcoin script language where there are ways that the money could either be spent in a way you did not intend, or in theory, you could also code an impossible to spend Bitcoin script. You could put a Bitcoin script in 1 = 2. And the Bitcoin script would never say 1 = 2, so it will always fail. So like, these are the things you have to be aware of. And what Miniscript does is it provides these little safe Lego bricks you can click in together to be able to properly execute a Bitcoin smart contract the way you intend it to be, in a very clean, human verifiable way.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I remember Rob, you know this, my first job when I finished undergrad was in the reinsurance industry. My job was to clean and help manage data sets. And that's through SQL. And that's when I gained an appreciation for the if, then, and, or statements in data. And I remember when we first had Beck on and she described what you guys were building. And then, of course, I was familiar with Lloyd's of London. I mean, I was already bullish on Bitcoin, but the fact that AnchorWatch was developing serious insurance solutions on top of it made me even more bullish, and bullish on AnchorWatch as well. But for the audience member who is maybe not as familiar with the insurance industry, can you explain a little bit the significance and weight behind being a cover holder of someone like Lloyd's of London?
Sure. Yeah. And maybe just to start, the idea around insurance, right, is that you have a contract that has certain triggers where if something were to happen, you get paid out something. People deal with home insurance, auto insurance, car insurance. People are like, highly, like at the high level as a consumer, are often aware of this. The insurance business, though, on the backside of the office, I think is infinitely more interesting, as I mentioned earlier, like a capital market. And so Lloyd's of London themselves are not an insurance carrier. The way I like to frame it is kind of like a trade organization of large insurance carriers. And if you've ever, I've been to the Lloyd's of London building. And what's interesting about it is that, one, it's an institution that's been around since the 1700s, Lloyd's Coffee Shop. So originally, with spice trading, basically you would have, and I like laying out this example because it kind of explains the concept of like how insurance came to be. You would have some young upstart captain that was ready to go on his expedition to Indonesia for spices. And then you would have a bunch of people who previously had sailed that route and were very experienced and wealthy because they made a lot of money in spice trading. And they would hang out at Lloyd's Coffee Shop and someone come and be like, I want to go do this adventure. And they'd be like, okay, interesting. If you give me 5% of your cargo, if anything goes wrong, I'll give you money so you can buy a new ship again. Because if your wealth was entirely in the ship itself and then something went wrong, you would be wiped out financially. So the idea of pooling risk became like part of this concept of like a way of growing wealth. And then additionally to that, because they were the experienced people who had done this route before, they would say, okay, but you need to take this exact route. Don't go here. Make sure you do X, Y, and Z. And then at the end, you get all these terms and then you get what's called the underwriter, and they would underwrite their signature and sign off on the commitment. And the significance of like the over the hundreds of years, is that this concept isn't just for spice trading. It's for any risk that's present in a market. And so for the significance of Lloyd's is that the longest standing, so going, like, actually seeing the building, you can see like whole rows of desks. Like this whole area is Latin American property insurance. And this whole row over here is doing health insurance in Asia, right? And then, like, you just, like, all these different groups and desks that are all working on different things. And I almost view it, and it's not exactly the same, but the concept, though, is, I like to say, like, if you go to the New York Stock Exchange and you see, well, now it's mostly computers and automated, but like back when you had people trading pieces of slips of paper, like for buying and selling stocks, Lloyd's of London is that, but for risk instead of equities. And so as this, like, large, like, centuries, multi-century, like, institution, being a Lloyd's cover holder is, we basically had built the trust, the network, and the relationship with them to show that the tech that we were explaining and how we specifically taking all of these Bitcoin things and explain it in their terms of mitigating risk, distributing risk, not concentrating it all into one place, was a very powerful framework for them to understand what we were building and how it was very much aligned and thought from an insurance first principle of how to safeguard the asset. And as a Lloyd's cover holder, when you get an AnchorWatch policy, while AnchorWatch is the one who does most of the underwriting and the sales and the distribution and the writing of a lot of, like, the program, at the end of the day, it's on Lloyd's of London paper, which means that in the event something goes wrong, it is not AnchorWatch individually who's responsible for paying you out. And to be very transparent, it has to be that way. If I am an early stage startup, I have the permission to be able to go underwrite a $100 million policy today. They're going to say, well, you don't even have $100 million on your balance sheet. And that's where the idea of ceding risk comes in. And it's Lloyd's of London who is backing the risk. So it gives us the ability to be deep subject matter experts in this particular domain and being able to get that credibility with them so that they understand the strength of the program and what we're offering. And we are able to mutually benefit by, we are able to find ways to put their capital to work, and we are putting ways and finding their capital to work. We're able to offer this product to a market that hasn't been able to exist before. And reciprocally, by putting their capital to work, we're helping them earn returns on their capital. And that's just like a thing to think about. If everyone is paying insurance premiums, if you stake a certain amount of capital as the underwriter saying, this is not risk-free yield. This is me as a risk capital saying, if something goes wrong, this capital will go out and pay people who have a claim. That flip side of that, though, is that people who are paying insurance premiums, that becomes yield on their capital, right? And So it's a mutually beneficial arrangement because we're able to help protect people and they're able to help earn a return on their capital.
Yeah, and you're certainly helping the asset class mature. I mean, it's an essential part, to your point earlier in the conversation, to any mature financial asset class, right? Maybe this is a good spot to get into some of the product offerings that AnchorWatch offers, Rob. So far we've talked about, you know, AnchorWatch as a broadly a custody and insurance provider for Bitcoin. What exactly are the product offerings, and can you, you know, walk us through the individual versus institution ones?
Yeah, so we launched in January of last year. So this was an observation. It did take us 3 years from the initial, like, I'm going to start a company on Clubhouse, to being live with an insured custody product. So last year we had one core product where it was insured custody, where you as the customer had three keys. We have three keys. And, you know, you would have to sign with two of your three keys to be able to move the money. And then we actually, the last 6 months, you as the customer only needed one key. And this, a nice visual that I could put along with this, but it was the idea of you had multiple keys, we had multiple keys, we kept things safe. Now, for this new year, there's several new products coming to light. The first one would be what I just described, but the customer just has one key. This is a bit of an iterative process when you're building a product to market. We built it thinking about all of the different movements and pieces. And then this is one of my observations in building a business, is that the iterative feedback loop in insurance is inherently slower, because I can't just be like, oh, I'm going to do this, click, 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 go, right? I have a counterparty who's offering the insurance capital, so I need to work with them. And there's not a problem with that in the sense of, like, we really do enjoy working with them, but I can't, like, wake up at 2 a.m. on a random Friday morning and be like, I just figured it out. Let me code this up and ship it, right? So on the insurance piece, there's a longer timeline. But we took all of our learnings over the past year and we were able to fold that into new insured custody products. So the first one, like I mentioned, was the customer just holds one key. With one key, you're still, for the length of the policy, the required cosigner. But there's less overhead for you as the customer to have to manage multiple devices. Additionally, we're going to be launching, as I would say, in the next week or so, multi-institutional custody. So think about it. Customer doesn't have to hold any keys at all. Additionally, we're also just launching uninsured. There were a lot of people. One, our insurance treaty specifically for us doing this product has to be specifically scoped into the United States. We can't sell because each jurisdiction has their own insurance regulations. Not to mention, some people were like, hey, I love the custody tech. I don't need the insurance. I understand it. Like, can I just do the uninsured custody? Previously, that wasn't an option. Now we can do uninsured custody for any of the vaults. Additionally, we have the ability to offer insurance white labeling our product. So basically the core engine and the tech that we've built, and this is something I'm very proud of in building our own infrastructure when it comes to the entire life cycle of a Bitcoin vault, we can offer that to someone else. And they can offer insured custody in their jurisdiction. And nothing to announce today, but that'll be imminently happening shortly. And then on multiple fronts. And then additionally, we also now have the authority to underwrite third-party platforms. So people who are not using the AnchorWatch Insured Vault custody, our subject matter expertise in understanding Bitcoin custody in general, being able to offer ways that we can offer insured custody for other platforms too. So those are like the big immediate things that are like our products that are live as part of like the Q1 2026 launch. I'm constantly thinking and chewing on new big ideas. So, but stay tuned on those. But that's what we have like live now. That's kind of new in the past month or so.
I want to just get back into the inheritance piece, which I think is so important because especially, I mean, the original Bitcoiners, you know, have Bitcoin. Often people in your life don't understand Bitcoin the same way you do, or don't appreciate it the same way you do, or you have trust issues, or you don't know. I mean, the whole idea of how do you leave it, even leaving it, you know, your seed phrase with an attorney has risk associated with it. But it seems like your uninsured custody, and I know you talked about it, but this could open up inheritance planning globally. Am I correct on that? So that even if you're outside of the jurisdiction of the United States, but you want to exercise that insurance aspect of it, where because of the time lock, it would enable your heirs to receive the Bitcoin without you ever having to pass your private keys to them, whether and you could be passing it to an entity, to an endowment, or to something like this. So I feel like that's a huge, huge issue that a lot of early Bitcoiners are hitting that age right now where you really are needing to think about passing along your Bitcoin.
Absolutely. Yeah. So for the inheritance piece, like that was one of the big drivers for uninsured custody because people just wanted to know that they had a reasonable inheritance solution stood up. And that's where we've gotten a lot of people proactively reaching out to us that were not marketing it as an inheritance solution. That was one of the first things as we launched. You always, like as an entrepreneur, you have a plan and idea about how you would execute something. But a very critical piece is listening to the market on that feedback loop. And that was something that we got overwhelmingly people reaching out, specifically identifying that as a core feature set. And that was definitely one of the motivations for offering uninsured for people who did one internationally. We wouldn't be able to service those customers now that they are serviceable. I think this is just a fundamental paradigm shift in how people think about Bitcoin, where you could lose your key or keys and still not lose the Bitcoin. And the way, again, without getting too technical, is you can program Bitcoin. If you're the level of technical I'll get is an if statement in computer programming. If sunny day run sprinklers, right? Like you can write a smart home software like that. Like if over a certain heat, like if something do something, and you can do that in Bitcoin today without any consensus change whatsoever. You could just have a Bitcoin address that has multiple ways you can spend from it. And by leveraging these time locks, introduces an entirely new paradigm as it relates to securing your Bitcoin. You could think of it almost like keeping your, like a bank vault. Like large bank vaults sometimes will have, even if you type in the keypad, you have to wait 30 minutes before the door opens. Why? It's a security feature. You don't want to be able to instantaneously walk into the vault and walk out with all the money. So the time locks, how they get managed in Bitcoin, is something that we're able to support and kind of tack on to the custody support. And that allows you to charge your Bitcoin in a way where, like, supercharge it, where it's not just being secure because I have different pieces of key information, but across time, the security changes too. And that's a way to not kind of have all of your eggs in one basket, where you could have it by default be, I have to sign the transaction. But if the money hasn't moved in 10 years, I want to be able to move it, right? And so these are, like, inheritance is a really interesting piece. And I think in general, what we started with AnchorWatch was insurance. But any financial product where there's a counterparty or something, Bitcoin has to move at some point for whatever reason, these are all things that you can encode in a Bitcoin address already today. And just thinking about it creatively and really deeply understanding the technical landscape to be able to execute on that, I think is one of those things that we are just starting to at AnchorWatch see the return and dividends of building out our infrastructure. And now the marginal effort for us to build new inheritance products, build new financial products, because we own and control our own tech destiny, is going to be quickly, like, compounding further and further.
You know, I want to get into the maybe a little bit of the founder mindset. So you touched on just now, you know, the feedback loop from launching products and what the market is telling you. And you mentioned you guys started with the individual self-custody model insured, and now you've expanded to the other product offerings that you mentioned, you know, the uninsured vaults, the white labeling, which opens up doors to all other sorts of jurisdictions. These are all in their own right, big undertakings, right? How do you as a founder strategically prioritize these product rollouts? It can be a bit of a challenge, right? I mean, and founders get all sorts of sometimes contradicting advice, you know, move fast, break things. Don't move too fast. You know, trust your gut, trust the market. The market's the one telling you. So what I would like to get from you is maybe a little bit into your early learnings as a first time founder and words of advice on what has gotten you to the success that AnchorWatch has built up until now, and how you look at the next couple of years.
Yeah. It's a great question. So there's a couple of pieces with that. I mean, I am CEO. I unofficially am also CTO, just by proxy of the nature of the business and the work that we do. And on an engineering side, being very thoughtful in thinking about in the initial design of things and trying to be very focused on tech debt. And a way I'd say that is that, like, over this past year, we launched our product in, you know, January. We hadn't launched a new product until, you know, a couple of weeks ago. That entire time was continually wax on, wax off, repolishing, refining things, figuring out ways to, not only as it's a living code base, how to execute, but being able to think about the future product, like, destination design, and being not constraining or preemptively, like, prematurely kind of boxing us into a certain way of doing things. The next thing is, it's very interesting as a general aside with this AI trend right now. While there are great accelerations of things to be done, I'm not vibe coding Bitcoin consensus code. I still very regularly, when I start, I'll throw a quick hack, like a quick, like, throwaway proof of concept, not tied to any of our existing infrastructure and idea. And it will hallucinate, like, even as of, like, this past week. Like, this is, like, even with the latest models, there'll be multiple things I'm like, that's not how that works. And maybe a year from now, that'll be gone. But I think there's a certain level of care and attention that's required for when the code is literally money, that you can't quite vibe, like, shortcut, move fast. When it, like, for the overall founder journey, I guess my biggest, like, things I think about is being okay to have a contrarian opinion. That was one of those things where when I first came up, like, with the core pieces of what became Trident Vault, a lot of people said, that's awesome, but, like, I'm not going to upgrade my node for that. And I'm like, it's already there. So people who, like, I'd known were in Bitcoin for years and years and years just had not thought about, within the existing design space, how do you kind of expand that? So giving yourself permission to break from the group. You have to give yourself permission to be able to entirely break from the group and thinking about how to design things in new ways. Keeping a team really lean. Beckett and I share this as a principle. Like I said, for the first year, it was myself, not taking a salary, Becca, and one engineer. we very slowly have hired. We're not quick to just kind of boost up on headcount. I find that smaller teams get a lot more done, which may sound counterintuitive. I think especially with this new wave of AI tooling, boosting productivity, that's going to become more and more true. Being, I would say, very disciplined with capital deployment, not just kind of throwing money around everywhere and just chasing, trying to spend $100,000 at a drop of a moment's notice because you think like maybe there's a chance that it'll maybe not even break even ROI, but bring in revenue in the door. Like being very thoughtful of treasury management, of engineering size and team, and also just being very picky on the people you hire too. Just those are very, especially like the size of our company right now at 7 employees, like each incremental person has a big change in the future direction of the company culture. So being very cognizant and careful of that. And for me, I'm not sure if this is just the way my brain works with like versus a general finder mindset, but I am constantly scanning around and thinking about problems from different perspectives where I'll listen to plenty of crypto podcasts just to understand what they're doing and thinking and talking about, right? And you don't want to put yourself in a position where you only want to be listening to people that are like very similar to your perspective. I try to enrich myself and think about things from many different things. There was when we first started going deeper and deeper into insurance, I bought a textbook on insurance, captive insurance, which is a way, it's a way of structuring insurance. And going deeply, deeply through that and just reading insurance textbooks would not have been like, I think maybe other people may not pull themselves down that path, but it was, I need to understand this stuff deep and cold and really think about it. And I think one of what this, these things unlock for you is you, and this is actually a Mark Andreessen principle of when he's like screening founders or talking to people maybe to invest in, he can tell that they've always gone one level deeper than what he can probe on. So like shopping for us to get, we didn't start at Lloyd's. We ended at Lloyd's. We easily spent talking to a dozen different insurance carriers. And one, that was really great for refining a pitch. But two, every single time they'd say, well, what about this? Well, what about that? What about this? We would always have an answer. And it was a well thought. It wasn't like live improv on the spot, like jazz hands trying to like live think about it. It was something that Becca and I would have conversations and deeply think about back and forth for a long time, right? And so those are the things I think is also not like you really have to accept extreme ownership of your actions and how you're like spending your time when you make a decision, committing to it, but also being willing to quickly change your mind in face of market feedback and ideas. And I know there's a lot of cliches for founders, but thinking through for me, that discipline of capital, discipline in hiring, constantly challenging yourself and kind of going to unexplored places and trying to find new ways to break from the group. Because you want to be breaking consensus if you're building something.
Another area of discipline for a founder is time management. And here you are working as the dual role of CEO, CTO, and you, but you also really contribute a lot to the community. I hear you on Spaces, you're still doing devs events, you're on podcasts, and you speak at conferences and share your knowledge because I do really value your thinking about this and how you go outside of the box to see solutions and to really delve into the technical part of it. How do you think about how much time you give to community, you know, and maybe that circles back to an earlier question about, you know, your early days in the New York Bit Devs, but how do you think about time management and what you devote to AnchorWatch versus family versus the community?
That's a great question. I think it's funny. So like I'll learn and think about like engaging with Twitter often like is where I'll start like getting inspiration for a new idea, people discussing something and me thinking about it differently. I think the live dialogue of conversation, whether it's at BitDevs or Twitter Spaces, is a great way to test your own knowledge. I mean, there's plenty of times where I'll be speaking matter of factly, I'll just be wrong on a factual issue. And so being willing to learn in public, I think is just a good skill in general for being able to compound your learning, right? Like being like, not only just like thinking, but also putting yourself out there in a way where you can get evaluated and learn more and kind of like patch your own maybe misunderstandings of the world. Another thing too is I don't travel often for conferences. Like I have a young family. I have a lot of juggling around multiple responsibilities, but I think there's easily a trap where it's like, I need to go to this big event and you're basically kind of like telling yourself that because you want to go on vacation and you want to go to a new city and hang out with friends and, you know, go to the bar and like you want to do all these things. And it's all this endorphin hits of like, it gives you the illusion of being productive, but it's actually like pretty bad. I think that was it was a tweet I saw probably, I forgot what year it was, but Alex Leishman from River made that point. Like something about like, you know, you have to really be careful with your time because like the amount of drag you get from going to the conference, coming back from the conference, catching up on the things you were not working on during the conference, you easily can get trapped into thinking you're so busy. Your calendar's full. You've been on the plane 3 times this month. You must be doing a lot of work and like, maybe not. And like, are those trips actually ROIing in a material way that actually justify the time you're spending? And I think this is one of the first bits of advice I got. It was actually also from American Huddle right when I started the company, was trying to spend focused 15-minute blocks of time with my family that I'm not on my phone. I'm not multitasking. I'm just there and present. And I'll be the first to admit that sometimes I'm not able to fully honor that and I'll get distracted. But I think in general, people appreciate that focused time. And even if it's in small bursts, better than kind of being passively around all the time.
There's a lot of great nuggets of advice there, Rob, and we appreciate the time getting back to, you know, time management. I'm sure the audience also will get a lot from everything we've discussed. I mean, you know, early in the podcast, you alluded to that when you were thinking about starting a company in the Bitcoin infrastructure space, you wanted to make sure it would be something big and that would have a critical impact on the trajectory of the infrastructure. I think it's safe to say you're well on your way to that path. AnchorWatch is certainly pioneering a lot of what we talked about today, you know, within the insurance industry and pricing risk, the programmability side of the Bitcoin mm-hmm. protocol. So there's a lot to be proud of, I'm sure. We're certainly fans of what you guys are doing and look forward to following the journey. As we kind of wrap things up, Rob, we'll kind of leave it to you to point people in the right direction. Where can people learn more about the product offerings, about AnchorWatch, yourself?
Yeah. So you can email me, rob@anchorwatch.com. My top priorities usually is when either a prospective customer or an existing customer like shoots me a note, I try to get back to them pretty quickly. You can follow me on Twitter @RobOneHam, ROB, the number one HAM. You can check out anchorwatch.com. You can sign up for our newsletter there if you want to be up to date on latest products and things that we're doing. And those are great ways to get hold of me, either through Twitter or email. I'm usually pretty quick to respond, and I'm always happy to set up time, do a call, to go more deeper into any of the different pieces I talked about today. You can also probably pull me up either on YouTube or your favorite podcasting app and just look for my name. Go on a whole gambit of podcasts, whether it's ones just talking about the tech for 2 hours or doing something more on the entrepreneurial spirit like this one. And I'm always available to, I'm an open book. And I guess that's one bit of advice too, is most people in this industry are very generous with their time. So I would leverage that as a way to, for your own self-learning and kind of validating a thesis. And if you're thinking about becoming an entrepreneur, thinking about that critically, and that there's a lot of people that have been around here for a while that are more than happy to grow the pie for everyone else, right? That's one thing for me too, is I try not to view everything as zero sum. I try to view as like all the things and pieces that we're doing here are ultimately additive for this larger vision of Bitcoin. And so I'm also an open book when it comes to that. If you ever want to reach out and ask for advice on starting a company or trying to do something, I'm more than happy to give you my 2 cents.
That's a beautiful sentiment. And I do feel like Israel and I are always feeling so blessed that we get the opportunity to meet with so many and hear the stories of so many entrepreneurs and how they think about growing Bitcoin and adding to the usability of it. So we really appreciate you and Becca and AnchorWatch and your generosity with your time.
Thank you. Yeah, well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Build with Bitcoin. If you found it of value, please take a second to like, subscribe, or share. This helps the visibility and reach of our podcast so that more people are aware of the innovation happening in and around Bitcoin. It truly means a lot. I'd also like to take this opportunity to invite you to join us at an event that Israel and I are hosting, Meet to Tech Talks 2026. taking place from October 25th to the 27th at the exclusive Punta Mita Resort in Mexico. This will be an intimate gathering of 125 invite-only participants exploring how the future of capital is being shaped by the intersection of Bitcoin, artificial intelligence, and energy. To request an invite or for more information, visit mitatechtalks.com. We hope you'll join us. And thanks again for being a part of the Build with Bitcoin community.